Yelp, OpenTable, Zillow, and more. As our revenue grew, and the stress of just making it through the next week and dodging the debt collectors faded, I found myself frustrated by a cycle that many businesses get stuck in. We were getting comfortable. The bills got paid. The clients were usually happy. They referred us to their friends. Our salaries went up a few $100s. These aren't bad things. But something was missing. I couldn't shake the feeling that our website was too popular for the consulting business to make sense. We had thousands of visitors every day, but could barely take on more than 6 or 7 active clients in a month. Consulting is limited entirely by time and people. It took me 2 to 3 nearly full days to put together a basic site audit with recommendations. We hired a couple of recent college grads who, after a few months of training, could do the same work, with some oversight and review from me, in a week. Then there was communication overhead and keeping up with industry changes and writing on the blog and closing new deals and the surprisingly time-consuming process of turning away work that wasn't a good match. We were immensely busy, but adding to our capacity only drained us more, as every hire required closing more clients and training time and reviews. Many businesses get stuck in this cycle, not wanting to scale because it creates more work and less profit margin in the short run, thus limiting their upside in the long run. Turning away business created this nagging sense in the back of my skull that we weren't executing on our opportunity, that SEO Moz could be more. Luckily for us, and mostly by accident, Moz transitioned from services to product. In late 2006, Matt and I hatched an idea to open up access to some of the proprietary tools we'd built to help with SEO tasks for our clients. Things like tracking rankings in the search engines and checking for problems that could harm visibility. We were mostly seeking more traffic for the website, but realized that having the tools available completely for free could overload our server bandwidth and cost way too much. Thus, we put the tools behind a $39 per month PayPal subscription. We figured this would help lessen the traffic overload risk and still get us more clients. We had no idea it would, almost overnight, lead to a transformation of Moz's business model. When the subscription to our tools opened in February 2007, it didn't feel like a momentous overnight transformation. A few new subscribers joined every day, but by and large, business carried on as usual. Our primary focus remained centered on consulting. It was only a few months later, while analyzing our revenue, that we saw the potential of the subscription business. The run rate of our new product was growing like a weed. By the end of that year, we did about $400,000 in SEO consulting revenue, our fourth year in that business, and $450,000 in software revenue, even though we'd only had 10 and a half months of it. It was a wake-up call to the power of having a product that made money while we slept. How to escape the services hamster wheel. Why is it that so few consulting businesses successfully launch a product? What made Moz's case unique? And why, given the success of our consulting efforts, did we decide to move to a software subscription model? There are two traits fundamental to an effective product-focused business. The first is reach. That is, the ability to influence a large audience. The second is scalability, that is, an aptitude for growing revenue far more quickly than costs. Traditionally, consulting businesses have little of either. Consultants don't need wide brand awareness or a large audience. They require only a small group of highly targeted individuals and organizations to be aware of their existence and services. Word of mouth is often enough to fill the pipeline for consulting businesses. In a product-based business, though, a much broader audience is typically required, and there's vastly greater need for brand awareness and market penetration. Word of mouth alone can power an exclusive list of enterprise-only product companies, but even then, the competitive landscape dictates a degree of coverage and scaled-up marketing that's almost never found in the consulting world. Consulting businesses are rarely scalable unless their firms are extremely well-staffed. Think Deloitte or McKinsey. And when they are, it's thanks to processes and people. In a product-based business, scalability comes from the adeptness of the product itself to serve a wide audience with a single offering or a range of products that all benefit from the same design and development process. In a consultancy, hours and projects are what customers pay for, rather than the goods or access, physical or virtual, that power a product-based firm. As we looked at the differences between our nascent software subscription business and our years-old consulting business in 2007, it became immediately clear that our bias would be to the software side of things. That's not because it's right for everyone, but because it was right for us. The things I love to do most, helping people, writing, speaking, building community, were the marketing channels that enabled us to attract customers and serve them well. The background in consulting gave us empathy for our customers because we'd done the same tasks they had and knew the products we, and thus often they, needed to better do our work. Unlike most consulting businesses, we could leverage a large community and a highly trafficked website we'd created on the side. We were committed to sharing knowledge openly with all of our competitors, and we happened to have a programmer on staff who could build software to scale our processes. We'd unintentionally invested in many of the pillars needed to create a successful product business. Our strengths in content, community, and reach meant that even though our first product wasn't great, we had branded ourselves as trustworthy operators in a field where that had historically been rare. But it wasn't just our strengths and passions that led us to software. The financial side had a big impact too. The revenue we earned from subscriptions had superior gross margins, far less time investment per dollar earned, and required very little hiring or contracting compared to our consulting work. We discovered, through trial and error, what financial markets have known for years. The dollars earned from a recurring revenue model are vastly more valuable than dollars earned from services, thanks to scalability and margin. Wait, so some money is worth more than other money? Financial models that value a company's revenue care a lot about gross margin. That is, the percentage of a business's or product's income that can be serviced without additional cost. If you build software and provide it to customers, your costs are basically maintenance of that software, hosting of the servers, any data you have to buy to keep the software operational, and not a lot else. Maybe customer service and support. Conceivably, you could shut down all new development efforts and let go of most of your staff, and the subscription dollars would keep coming in. Hence, gross margins on software product businesses are often higher than 75 to 80%, while the margins on a consultancy are more likely in the 25 to 40% range. These distinctions affect not just the business's revenue generation process, but how they're valued by potential buyers and investors too. Every dollar you make from services will net you, on average, 1 to 2 times the amount in an acquisition or valuation scenario. This formula for a product-driven business, like our software subscription, is often in the 3 to 8 times range. Say we have two entrepreneurs who've built similarly sized, strong businesses over the last few years and are both ready to sell and retire. Nikki's firm is a software subscription business, and Silvio's is a consulting firm. Both have 50 employees, $10 million in revenue over the past 12 months, and a growth rate of 30%. In each of the last 4 years. My examples here are vastly oversimplified, but the raw average outcomes are instructive. Nikki can reasonably expect that her company will yield, on the very low end, $30 million, and on the high end, $80 million in a sale. It could be even higher if her technology is especially in demand, or if the skill sets of her engineers, the unique data she's collected, or the market she's tackling is massively interesting to multiple powerful companies. Silvio can probably anticipate a sale of $10 million to $25 million for his similarly sized business. The modifiers will generally be his company's EBITDA, that's earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization, his net margins, aka profitability, and some elements of relative demand, bidders, and industry. Little wonder that investors, then, put so few dollars into consulting businesses and so many into software companies. And little wonder, too, why, at Moz, once we started to understand these numbers, we quickly doubled down on software and put less energy into expanding consulting. I'd like some services, please. Should every consultant or services-based business try to shift to a product or subscription model? Definitely not. Despite the example in the previous section, the delta in outcome for many product-based businesses isn't nearly as dramatic as the technology media makes it out to be. It's true that product companies usually get more attention and coverage. Salesforce and MailChimp have numerous write-ups in national newspapers and fawning descriptions of their founders' brilliance. That seldom happens to consultancies. But services-based businesses still have many great strengths that deserve consideration. Little to no startup capital is required. You can build these companies from home with nothing but your own time, energy, and effort. You can entirely control the scale, expenses, and profitability of your business with far greater precision by taking on more or fewer clients, raising or lowering prices, and doing the work yourself versus hiring or outsourcing. If and when you choose, you can take time away from the business with far less harm to its long-term potential. No new clients for a month and no deliverables committed means a month with family or on vacation. You will almost never need to give up ownership or shares in the company, which has tax benefits, using an S corporation or LLC, which most consultancies do, means neither profits nor salaries get taxed twice, and leaves you in full control. This isn't to say that a software or products business cannot do this, just that it's much less likely, especially if you want or need to raise capital. In general, hiring costs are much lower in consultancies, because most types of consultants tend to have lower salaries on average than software or product engineers, designers, and marketers. People retention is less challenging, and the benefits or perks are not expected to compete with those of Google, Facebook, and others of their ilk. Most surprisingly, services firms are often a superior financial deal for a founder. Don't believe me on that last point? Let's go back to our comparison of Nikki and Silvio. As Nikki started her software business, she raised two rounds of financing. $500,000 from angel investors in exchange for 30% of the company's equity, and later a Series A round from a venture investor of $8 million in exchange for an additional 40% of equity. These modest investments and the 15% of shares in the company she put in the employee option pool and distributed to team members meant that, upon sale, she owned 15% of the company she started. That's slightly higher than the median startup founder who owns only about 11% of his or her company's shares at exit. Silvio, on the other hand, didn't seek outside investors and retained 100% ownership of his consultancy, standard for businesses of that type. So who is ahead when it's time to sell? If we presume each got the median valuation for their sale, Nikki made 15% of $40 million, or $6 million, and Silvio made 100% of $15 million. Despite the massively higher valuations of software revenue, Nikki made $9 million less than Silvio. That is a lot of money. In fact, my friends, it's twice what the original Adam West TV series Batmobile sold for at auction in 2013. Silvio has two Batmobiles more than Nikki, which I think we'd all agree is the single greatest indication of wealth. However, if, as a founder of a product company, you're able to retain a larger than average share of your business, it's a great deal. If Nikki held on to 60% of the company she started, again, presuming the two founders got the median valuation for their sale, she'd make $24 million. That's 60% of the $40 million versus Silvio's 100% of $15 million. The point is, you could get an extra Batmobile if things go right. maybe two. But this conversation is moot if the business fails. 15% of zero is bupkis. And tech startup failure rates don't apply to the services category with nearly the same ferocity. In 2012, Scott Shane of Small Business Trends analyzed U.S. Census Bureau data and found that services firms have some of the best survival rates among small business types. 47.6% make it past year 5 of operation. Contrast that with the less than 25% of tech startups that do. You are, statistically, almost twice as likely to make it as a services business than as a technology product firm. But weirdly enough, you'll almost never read about acquisitions of services firms in the tech press. You'll almost never see a 7, 8, or even 9-figure merger or acquisition from the consulting world make it to even the bottom of tech meme, or get a tweet mentioned by a prominent figure in the startup world. The focus is almost entirely on product companies, VC-backed companies, and those few in the United States with connections to the major media outlets of tech's insular ecosystem. In my opinion, this isn't just correlated with the perception of services firms, it's causal. I have a lot of friends and colleagues who run consulting companies. Whenever we talk finances, they're blown away that, with a few hundred thousand or million in revenue, they are often personally much, much better off financially than my wife and I. How can that be? They'll ask when I share our fiscal situation. Well, I say, I have a salary at Moz, and I have my stock, but I can't pay myself any of our profits. And until or unless the company sells or goes public, my stock is illiquid. Damn. They always shake their heads. A $45 million a year business doesn't make you rich. Weird. I'll dive more deeply into the monetary machinations of venture-backed founders in Chapter 8. Stay tuned. How to push your product. I don't mean to unfairly or irrationally condemn a product focus. There are a number of good reasons to choose a product business over a services one. Your passion is to build product, not to do consulting. You love marketing to a broad, diverse audience rather than networking and building a reputation among a more niche group. You will not be satisfied with yourself or your accomplishments until you try the product path. You accept the larger risks, higher failure rates, and more intensive capital demands in exchange for the potentially larger rewards that come with a product-centric company. You crave the attention, press, and long-shot odds of becoming wealthy enough to make Solomon blush. This was the case with Moz all those years ago, and so a transition to product made sense. If you're in the same boat, here's the best advice I have on how to make this transition go smoothly. Start with a product that's informed by your consulting. The services you provide expose you to real-life problems that consumers and organizations face. You have solutions in the form of applied knowledge for which people are willing to pay. Your experience can inform a product's design, content, marketing, amplification, and even the early parts of audience building. Moz's consultancy certainly did that for me. It showed the real challenges organizations of all sizes faced with SEO. It exposed me to hundreds of scenarios and problems, many of them overlapping, and gave me the knowledge of how to solve them that I could share transparently with others, which built the basis for my blog. Before I ever designed a tool, I knew exactly what issues I wanted to solve, and more important, I knew there were many others like me trying to solve those same problems. Thousands of them had already commented on my blog, and helpfully opted in for email messages. Build a scalable marketing practice that attracts your product's audience. Because so much of consulting business is driven by small-scale marketing and word of mouth, it's rare to find a consultancy seeking to build a sizable audience. But this is precisely what gave Moz the ability to scale its software product after launch. And if you can leverage marketing channels for your consultancy in the short term, with an eye to your product business in the long term, you'll be vastly ahead of the game. The key is to find channels of attraction with enough overlap to accommodate both the audience you need now, services clients, and the ones you need to reach in the future, product buyers. Use the services revenue to fund the product's creation and testing. don't let obsession with your new idea overtake your focus on the consulting business's success. It can be tempting to devote the majority of your time and the business's resources to product development, especially when you're excited about what you're creating. And you better be damned excited, because that passion will be needed to get through the ugly parts of product scaling. But if you cut short your consulting revenue, or fail to fill your pipeline with new clients, or let your work quality suffer, your adventure could be over before it begins. When I talk to founders who've attempted this shift, three big things are almost always holding back a successful transition. 1. Comfort with the existing model and the reliance on services income to survive. 2. The undistracted time needed to build a great product. 3. The difficulty of finding enough of the right customers for that product. It's rare that your services clients are the perfect match for your product, because fundamentally, they need services, not a product. That's why they're your customers. This is why you can't simply transition services clients to product customers, despite the seeming appeal and overlap. If you internalize these challenges ahead of time, you can form testable theories of how to overcome them. If you recognize the odds, the sacrifices, and the upsides of both models, you can wisely choose between them. And hopefully, you can learn from Maz's experiences and make use of our tactics to ease a potential pivot. Consulting isn't the enemy. Biased thinking is. So which model is right for you? Let's directly compare the two. In a services business, startup costs are low. In a product business, they're high. 5-year average survival rates for a services business are mediocre, 47% according to U.S. Census data. In a product business, they're miserable, less than 10% according to NVCA data. The marketing demands for a services business are low. For a product business, they're high. The limits to growth for a services business are people, marketing, and retention. In a product business, that's going to be capital, engineering, and customer acquisition. Competitive barriers to entry for a services business are low. In a product business, they're medium to high. The scalability of a services business is low. For a product business, very high. Staffing requirements in a services business, you've got a high ratio of staff to customers. In a product business, you have a low ratio of staff to customers. Gross profit margin is going to be low in a services business and high in a product business. And net profit margin in a services business will be medium. In a product business, it's going to be low, often due to reinvestment for growth. Clearly, the answer to the product versus services debate is, it depends. Smart founders need to use their best judgment about their strengths, their goals, and their market to determine whether one model is a clear winner and/or whether it pays to experiment with some of each. Unless you're expressly seeking to raise money from venture investors, nothing's stopping you from offering a subscription product to your services clients or from adding consulting services to your product business. Don't let Silicon Valley culture's traditional thinking on this bias you away from the right decision for your company and your customers. Chapter 3. Great founders don't do what they love. They enable a vision. Your work is going to fill a large part of your life, and the only way to be truly satisfied is to do what you believe is great work, and the only way to do great work is to love what you do. That's Steve Jobs in 2011. Can I geek out for a minute? I love SEO. I love how small changes to a web page can make a marked difference in how it appears in search engines and how that drives hundreds or thousands of people to visit my site. I love the combination of technical skills and creativity required to overcome the competition for a tough keyword. And I love the mystery of how search engines rank pages and the process of uncovering each little piece of that puzzle. When I find a new tactic or uncover a subtlety in Google's ranking process, my eyes light up. I do my best, deepest work, going for hours on the pure delight of discovery and intrigue, desperate to prove my hypothesis about what's happening in the millions of mathematical calculations that drive visibility on the web. If I get enough evidence and can repeat the experiment consistently with ranking success, I'm elated. I'll run around my apartment, fist pumping in the air like a scrawny, nerdy, Jewish Rocky Balboa. Avert your eyes, neighbors. Not all our windows have blinds. I'll spend hours more writing up and visually documenting my work for a blog post or a presentation. When I finally hit publish or step on stage to share my findings, it's the pinnacle of my professional endeavors. Sharing that knowledge and removing that shroud of opacity from how these systems that govern what billions of people experience every day through search is what I love to do. So obviously, as CEO of an SEO company, I should be happy as a clam, right? I'm living the admittedly nerdtacular dream, aren't I? CEO is a real shitty job. Early in my career as an SEO consultant, a majority of my days were spent actually doing the work I loved. But after the company started on a serious growth trajectory and I assumed the role of CEO, I probably spent less than 20% of my time doing those things, and it often dwindled to less than 5% for months at a time. We grew fast, and it was my first time doing anything and everything a CEO has to do. The learning curve was steep and uncomfortable. I didn't just have to learn. I had to immediately apply that knowledge and iterate it until I got it right. The stakes were high. Employees were relying on me to assign the right projects that would help make our software better or help us reach a broader audience. Customers were relying on me to build and support SEO tools that were better than their manual alternatives or our competitors' tools. Investors relied on me to hire staff, to execute on projects, to report how things were going, to maintain financial discipline, and, most important, to grow fast. And of course, our community of hundreds of thousands of marketers relied on me to investigate, educate, and publish nightly about the search and web marketing fields. No big deal, right? Cue hyperventilation. I remember a single week in October 2009 when I was recruiting a new CTO, grasping at the desperate end of a failing fundraising process with a number of Silicon Valley VCs, preparing presentations for two upcoming conferences, negotiating new salaries and stock compensation with senior members of our engineering and operations teams, designing the wireframes for a major new product initiative, Open Site Explorer, which would go on to be one of our most popular products, promoting a book I'd co-authored for O'Reilly Media, The Art of SEO, and, unbelievably, meeting with some senior tech staff from the United Nations to talk about how search visibility might be helpful to them. Also, figuring out what I was going to be for Halloween. I ended up going as a red-shirted ensign. You know, the guys who are first to die tragically on Star Trek. Let's not read into that. I did virtually no hands-on SEO. The myth of founding a startup so you can do what you love is at least as enshrined in the tech world's popular culture as the myth of getting rich. It deserves to be unpacked and examined. There's a grain of truth that lies within, albeit a grain buried under layers of maddening falsehood. Passion does not a manager make. If you didn't have a pre-existing notion of what startup entrepreneurship looks like, it might seem logical to imagine a series of events something like this. The entrepreneur graduates college, works for a year or two in a field that provides broad exposure to many different types of businesses, perhaps consulting, gets an MBA, does a thorough analysis of potential opportunities in a variety of fields, identifies the one with the least competition and highest demand potential, creates product, marketing, and scaling plans, fundraises, and then starts a company. Hell, it sounds reasonable to me. But we know from data and from experience that most entrepreneurs and an overwhelming majority of the most successful entrepreneurs don't start out with anything close to this level of deliberate evaluation. Instead, we dive headfirst into the thing we're passionate about, without even considering the alternatives, the market risks, the competitive landscape, the long-term demand curves, and macroeconomic forces that might indicate it's a terrible time to start a new science of pasta-making website that relies entirely on cheap ads for revenue. But maybe someday we'll also make our own pasta and sell it on the site. Because damn it, we love pasta! And we want to share our passion with a world of people who love it too, but don't know what to buy or how to cook it. People who have yet to learn the handful of little secrets that transform cacio e pepe, a Roman pasta with cheese and black pepper, from a five-ingredient bowl of mush to the most satisfying, addictive, and unbelievably delicious dish you can make in 12 minutes flat. Entrepreneurs start out doing what they love, not because it makes sense or because it's a great market, but because they cannot imagine themselves doing or eating anything else. On the one hand, that passion and commitment is an asset. It can help early-stage companies push through the ugly barriers that make it so difficult to find a business model. On the other, once there's a small working operation that's found revenue, the leadership needs to refocus on all the tasks a growing organization demands. Testing ingredients, taking photos, finding obscure forgotten recipes, and sharing them with the world may have gotten you where you are, but it won't take you from food blogger to media empire. When your startup is growing, the tasks and competencies change every 6 months. From 2007 to 2014, the most important things I did were never the same for longer than that. There were parts of each new job I enjoyed, but I clung for far too long to elements of work I should have delegated, reasoning, as almost every entrepreneur I've talked to does, that it was a core competency for the business, that I could do it better than anyone else, and that I could handle that work plus my other responsibilities. I held on to near complete control of our blog, using the logic that my posts were what had built the company's reputation, even though diversity of content and more of my freed up time could have seriously bolstered our product and engineering. I maintained ownership and reviews of our consulting work, which we kept up until 2010. I insisted on being our primary product designer and on having final say over every nook and cranny for years, which held back growth from other team members and slowed down product improvements dramatically too. Unless what you love is managing people, handling crises, delegating, holding people responsible, recruiting, setting, then constantly amplifying and repeating the company's mission, vision, strategy, and values, being a startup CEO may not provide you with the work you love to do. Instead, a startup provides the ability to create a vision you love and to see it through to fulfillment. You get to say, today, the world works this way. But once the company I'll build exists, and once it reaches the scale to fulfill its ongoing mission, the world will change to this. If you can reset your passion from, I want to do this work, to, I want to see something I create change the world in this way, your expectations will align with reality, and the cognitive dissonance and frustration of being torn away from the work you love can fade. Note that change the world doesn't have to mean change the whole world. Your mission could be to make available and accessible the delicious, neglected pasta recipes of Emilia Romagna. It might be to give the people of Seattle a better, more fulfilling experience with yoga. Or it might be to eradicate student loan debt and class stratification worldwide by building an affordable educational platform with the rigor and brand respect of Harvard at the cost of a Netflix subscription. Side note, please someone do this. But if your mission is to do the work I love doing without letting the business get in the way, I strongly recommend against pursuing growth that demands more people on your team. Hiring people adds organizational complexity, the mortal enemy of heads-down, passion-focused, deep work. How to be a CEO in six easy, scratch that, infuriatingly challenging steps. If you're ready to accept this limitation in the work you'll get to do, and to put shepherding your vision ahead of doing what you love, you have a new set of challenges ahead. Great startups aren't built by people who never gain competence beyond their particular field. They demand proficiency in financial strategy, task planning, human resources, conflict resolution, office management, fundraising, customer support, payment collections, business intelligence, and dozens of other functions founders rarely consider in the early stages. You'll get to learn each of these through a process the startup world affectionately calls muddling through. I prefer the more accurate description, wading into a painful slog of failure, learning, and repetition. In essence, you'll 1. Realize, frustratingly late, a particular pain point that's holding your team back from effectively or efficiently accomplishing a goal. For example, you can't run the A/B tests on your website because you have no framework for measuring results, nor any expertise in how to build effective tests. 2. Attempt a variety of techniques to overcome that pain point. Hiring people with previous competency in the practice, researching and learning it yourself, delegating the learning to other team members, acquiring technology or data, implementing a rigid new process, etc. 3. Determine that most of the things you've tried have failed, and cycle through many more until you 4. Experience the elation of breaking through, at least partially, and finding some success. 5. Uncover new frustrating side effects and unintended consequences of your solutions. 6. Half the time, settle for partial implementation and a set of compromises that work well enough to become the new norm. The other half, realize that the solutions are worse than the problem and determine a way to simply avoid or ignore the pain point, possibly by refocusing your strategy so you simply don't have to deal with it. I'll share an example from Moz. From 2004 to 2012, project planning followed a very informal path at the company. I'd sit down with one or a handful of our team members, talk about what they could be working on, what they wanted to work on, what we thought would be best for the business, and through those weekly or monthly conversations, establish a roadmap. Sometimes we'd change it over an email thread or through a hallway chat, and sometimes we'd do a decent job of broadcasting the plans to the rest of the company. But things were small enough, at least when we had fewer than 30 people across our 4 functional teams, that this informal process mostly worked. But by 2010, the 40-ish folks inside Moz got frustrated that knowledge about what each person and team was working on was mostly held in a janky combination of A, Rand's memory banks, B, random email threads, and C, a wide variety of project tracking systems, some of which were used by only one person. The frustration amplified when projects would cross teams and drag people off their individual tasks to collaborate at inconvenient or unexpected times. To combat this, we tried a quarterly cadence of all-hands meetings, during which I, or the department head, would run through all the projects on the calendar for the next 2 or 3 months. This alleviated some pain, but created plenty of new ones. So, we tried a series of weekly emails. Each team would send out their in-progress projects and next set of expected work each Friday. By the time we had broad adoption of this practice, there was a massive amount of all-staff emails going out each Friday, most of which were ignored by most people in the company. Complaints about this glut of no-one-reads-them emails led to a consolidated process where each week, one technical project manager, TPM, would get all the teams' reports and put them into a single, very long Friday email. If you were diligent enough and had the patience, you could scroll through that list and see what everyone was doing and what they had planned next. It basically only worked well for one person. Me. I love email. I'm good at it, and very often I'd be the only person replying with questions and clarifications on those threads. As you might imagine, that practice neither scaled nor worked well for anyone else. When Sarah Bird became Moz's CEO in 2014, more about that to come, she implemented a new system of quarterly planning meetings with facilitated discussions between teams over 2 to 3 days in a large room filled with poster boards on which each team's projects were listed out for discussion and markup. For those few days, representatives from each team, along with managers and executives, would huddle together and talk through every project and plan, determine work sequencing, and argue over priorities. And many times Sarah herself would have the final say about which piece mattered most. First to go were the outside facilitators, which many, myself included, felt were inauthentic and created more complexity and process than necessary. Then the meeting shrunk to 1.5 days as additional elements of discussion and negotiation were pared back. And finally, after realizing that the process was simply too demanding and didn't provide enough value to justify its ongoing existence, Sarah eliminated it altogether. She reorganized the company into functional business units with a smaller number of shared services departments and shifted to a model where broadcasting everything everyone was working on was no longer required. Each team was given more autonomy to determine its own roadmap and less reliance on other teams to get their work done. The pain subsided. The pace of progress increased. And despite, or perhaps by virtue of, not always knowing what everyone else was doing, Moz's employees felt less frustrated, less overwhelmed, and more focused. I'm skipping over a ton of the incremental steps, hard decisions, and tedious changes designed to address the struggles that arose throughout this process, but the narrative remains. It's probably familiar to anyone who's worked in a scaling organization, and it's critical to understand if you're going to build a company designed to grow. It took 6 years, more than 10 iterations, and 2 CEOs to find a process that worked for product planning at Moz. In the end, Sarah made the tough but smart choice to avoid the problem altogether by restructuring the company. The best leaders know when to lead and when not to. Many founders believe they can delegate key business functions to other people on their team, and often they should. But your first hires in any of these roles will need guidance, support, input, and occasionally you'll need to dig into the details yourself because you can't find the right person, or you had to let them go, or you simply need to know more about the issues before you can determine whether the problem lies with your people, your management, your processes, or something else. I hired multiple CTOs to run the technology side of our business, but never got to know the processes well enough to support or mentor a technology leader. Sarah did likewise, but finally buckled down and decided to dig into the role herself. We actually fought about it. A lot. I was angry that she wasn't recruiting a CTO after we lost Anthony, our 4th engineering leader in 6 years. She countered that until she spent time understanding and leading that part of our business herself, she didn't feel confident in hiring an effective outsider. It was a point of contention for more than a year between us, but she proved to be totally right. Her insider knowledge of the teams and people, the work needed, the relationships and conflicts proved instrumental in finding a great tech leader, hiring him, and then eventually promoting him to the position of CTO. Sarah and I both delegated a set of work we weren't cut out for. Neither of us have particularly technical backgrounds, but we didn't get it functioning smoothly until she invested the time to understand the practice herself. This is the work entrepreneurs do in growing organizations: digging into problems, untangling conflict, freeing people from the mindsets or structures that hold them back, crafting and refining over and over the pillars and policies of how the company functions. The hours you spend on the business will shift from doing what you love to enabling a vision and navigating whatever impediments arise along the way. Expect to do work you don't love in order to allow what you do to flourish. If you don't, the disappointment and frustration can kill your motivation. Embrace that reality, though, and you'll come to see the CEO role as one of enabler and problem solver. For those who love helping others get unblocked and watching progress scale far beyond what they could achieve alone, this can be an immensely rewarding job. Chapter 4. Beware the pivot. Ideas are worthless. Execution is everything. That's Scott Adams in 2010. Fittingly, most of Scott's own ideas about ethics, politics, and humanity are complete crap. Don't read his blog unless you're ready to watch a talented cartoonist reveal himself to be a shitburger of a person. There's an idea floating in the mythos of Silicon Valley's hallowed halls that the pivot is a fundamental right bestowed upon all startups, designed to help absolve the sins of your past incarnation and allow you, too, to go from tote to Pinterest, Odeo to Twitter, or Glitch to Slack. If the decisions upon which you founded your business prove foolhardy, never fear. The pivot will save you. It's more important to get started than to spend months evaluating and choosing a wiser path. The path can never be known. The path must be discovered by trying and failing and, you guessed it, pivoting. Bollocks. In the annals of startup history, there are tens of thousands of companies that achieved remarkable success. Hundreds of millions or billions of dollars in returns, a lasting impact on their ecosystems or industries, delighted customers and users, and a financially well-compensated founding team that now spends their days swimming in a pit full of gold coins. Side note, everything I know about the lifestyles of the wealthy comes from Scrooge McDuck. But among all those successful companies, how many great pivots were there? If we're using the formal definition of migrating completely from one business idea to a radically different one, all my research could uncover only a few dozen. Slack, Flickr, Twitter, Pinterest, PayPal, Groupon, and Instagram aren't just among the most famous, they're among the only ones, at least of those that have achieved truly lofty, founders now have a gold coin-filled swimming hole success. This should come as no surprise. Pivots don't happen on a whim. You change your business model, your product, your market, or your entire idea, only if things are going very poorly indeed. Anything else would be foolhardy. If it ain't broke, don't pivot. It's nasty, ugly, hard, grueling work building these things in the first place. And if you've achieved any progress whatsoever, you're likely to stick with it, learn, and improve. Given this reality, it might pay to be less cavalier and more analytical in your approach to choosing an industry, an idea, a product, and a target customer. It may also pay to choose a field others ignore because it's perceived as unsexy, sketchy, or uninteresting by some other vanity-centric logic. In my case, Moz picked a field experiencing massive growth, being found in search engines during Google's dramatic rise, and a model that scaled wonderfully, software to help marketers and SEOs do their work more efficiently with better results. And we spent our energy iteratively improving. We got better at marketing, at building software, at collecting data, at designing product interfaces, at retaining subscribers, and at all the other things core to our business. We favored improving execution over changing our model, market, or fundamentals. From 2007 to 2013, that brought us 100% year-over-year growth, leadership in our space, a variety of accolades, and the adoration of our customers and investors. Execution is more malleable than market, model, and idea. I started writing about SEO in 2003. Back then, very few people were doing so, and even fewer were doing it in a transparent way that helped others learn the practice. There was a pervasive belief in the field that sharing too much about how search engines worked or what tactics earned rankings could put you out of business. Many SEO consultants perceived their secret sauce knowledge to be more important to their clients than the work itself. That secrecy, combined with the unpopularity of the industry, gave my blog a unique advantage. It stood out among the available offerings for its open, transparent approach to the subject matter. The writing certainly wasn't anything special. The advice itself wasn't vastly superior to what others had. But while our competitors were mostly unwilling to share this kind of information without a signed NDA and a consulting fee, SEOMoz.org required nothing but a browser visit. As a result, other sites linked to me. Press outlets cited my posts. Consulting clients found their way to our contact page. And thousands of industry practitioners, hungry for knowledge, signed up for daily updates. Fast forward to 2007, when we launched our subscription business. The tools contained there weren't especially great. They were often broken or overloaded. The data they gave back was mediocre at best. But digital marketing was a fast-growing field. SEO was heating up as a practice, and there were almost no other sources of automation for folks who couldn't write their own software. So Moz stood out. In both of these cases, we were mediocre providers who, over time, dramatically improved our offerings. My writing in 2004 was pretty sad. You can still find those early blog posts on moz.com/blog and see for yourself. It was at least a few years in before I was producing anything that could be called high quality. Similarly, when we launched our software via that $39 per month PayPal subscription, the toolset was lackluster, the features subpar, and the usability just a hair better than atrocious. What did we do right? We picked a good market. We stumbled onto a compelling communication medium, and we chose a good business model. These inadvertently wise choices covered up a tremendous number of mistakes and a steep learning curve. I published no fewer than 1,000 blog posts before my posts achieved consistent, broad readership that earned the kind of value we see with published content today. From late 2003 to early 2007, I wrote for an hour or a few 5 nights a week, Sunday through Thursday. And I'd spend additional hours the next morning promoting the posts, replying to comments, and finding new topics to cover. By the time the blog appeared on must-read lists, I'd invested hundreds of hours researching and writing. I started out an amateur, but today have a massive following and the ability to generate tens of thousands of visits, resonant messages, and powerful business impacts via my blogging. The software side of Moz has uncanny parallels. Our first tools were barely worth the subscription prices. But over many years, we got better at software development processes, at affording and hiring great engineers, and at designing more useful applications. From a few dozen subscribers to tens of thousands, from an average customer lifetime value of a couple hundred dollars to more than $2,000, we improved in every facet of the SaaS model, software as a service, wherein subscribers are charged on a recurring basis to access software via a website or internet-connected app. We love to praise execution, as if executing well on any dumb old idea would take us somewhere. Sure, immense dedication, skill, and the hard work of great people can overcome most obstacles. But choosing wisely at the start, the field, the approach, the customer target, the economic model and the marketing methodologies has a massive impact on the difficulties you'll face and how forgiving the journey will be. Not everyone can afford the costs of starting over. Not everyone has the privilege of being able to test hypotheses willy-nilly. If you have a family, if you have debts, if your cost of failure is anything but zero, it makes better sense to tread carefully. The switching costs can kill you. Here's the weird thing about this argument in favor of pivoting. Execution is far more fungible than your idea, your business model, the industry you choose, or even your team. What happens as a startup makes progress? The team improves the quality of its work. Customer service folks improve their response times. Product features and functionality catch up to customer needs. Engineers deliver better technology. User experience goes from bare bones to impressive. The marketing funnel widens. Conversion rates go up. If you're prioritizing execution and learning from your mistakes, you're already doing this. Now, imagine how hard it is to move from targeting one market to another. Many of the hard-won lessons your marketing team or salespeople or business development folks have earned are useless. You're back to square one on how to attract customers, how to close deals, how to retain their loyalty. Yikes. Say you switch your idea or product. You'll throw out months or years of sweat and toil validating a concept, earning customer buy-in, and attracting influencers, press, and perhaps even investors. Maybe this new product or service will be easier to build than your last one. But it's not free. And it's certainly going to set you back on every other vector, including customer traction and acquisition. Or maybe you're changing from one business model to another. It may be a smaller shift than the two above, but it still takes a vast degree of energy and likely means migrating your customers, if they'll come, from one system of compensation to another. Don't believe the hype. Execution isn't everything. You can be the tortoise rather than the hare, and by picking the right race and the right route, win over far more talented teams because you're constantly improving in a less crowded space no one else has chosen. Some unorthodox tips on choosing your market and your idea. If you haven't already read Eric Ries's book, The Lean Startup, go do that now. Then pick up Sprint by Jake Knapp and the Google Ventures team. The first one will help you nail the basics of choosing and validating a market, and the second one shares my favorite method for nailing new products and features. Now that you're analyzing competitors' unique value propositions like a boss and rattling off sarcastic product market misfit jokes with the best of them, I've got a few additional suggestions. Number one, if you can keep your ego and your aspirations below the need to pursue venture capital in order to aim for a billion-dollar unicorn, you can ignore a lot of the advice about choosing a giant, fast-growing market ripe for disruption. Instead, it's totally cool and may make your life vastly easier to chase after smaller markets where you have unique knowledge and passion and where ongoing smaller amounts of innovation can separate you from the pack. There are thousands, maybe millions of opportunities like these with dramatically fewer venture dollars and Harvard MBAs or Stanford CS dropouts chasing them. Because let's face it, most of us aren't going to be innovators in humankind's quest to explore outer space, but we might be able to develop a better way to clean out a garbage disposal than, say, sticking your hand down it. Number two, great ideas and products are often born from mediocre ones. The keys are time, enough to iterate and evolve into something remarkable, humility, enough to see what's wrong and admit a failure so you can move forward, and survival. A profitable services business can be a godsend here. Number three, your business will be even more likely to succeed if the market you target is served by incumbent solutions that are some combination of A, hated by their customers, B, unwilling or unable to evolve with their customers' needs, C, protected by competitive advantages you can unravel, or that a shift in market dynamics or regulation is unraveling for you, or D, in their early stages and not yet dominant, that is, a non-mature market. If you find a market with two or more of these, think vacation home rentals before Airbnb or crowdfunding before Kickstarter, your odds rise exponentially. Number four, keyword research, wherein you uncover what words and phrases people are searching Google for and in what quantities, will almost always uncover untapped opportunity. Move beyond the solution keywords and look for searches that indicate problems. The quantity of monthly searches for city name plus taxi helped Uber figure out which cities to launch in, just as the monthly searches for best restaurant in city name helped Yelp pick their expansion markets. Two good tools for this. Google's AdWords program. You don't need to buy ads, just sign up for free. And Moz's Keyword Explorer. A shameless plug, but it really is the best tool out there. All that said, if you have to compromise on several elements, and you almost certainly will, I'd urge you to sacrifice market size, lack of or weak competition, and sales and marketing tactics in that order before you endeavor to tackle a field where your abilities don't create a competitive advantage and a unique value proposition. It's that important. Chapter 5. Startups carry their founders' baggage. Writing code, that's the easy part. Getting your application into the hands of users and creating applications that people actually want to use, now that's the hard stuff. That's Jeff Atwood, March 2010. It's probably no big surprise to hear that a company inherits its founder's attributes, whether they be good or bad. Install a misogynist as CEO, and you'll find that the company has misogynistic practices. Uber. Back a founder with self-worth issues, and they'll often overcompensate through political power plays and a lack of sharing credit. Study enough startups, and you'll see this pattern over and over. Amazon inherited Jeff Bezos's passion for logistics just as surely as his thriftiness with employee pay and benefits and proclivity for causing burnout. Craigslist reflects founder Craig Newmark's near Luddite innovation sensibility alongside his desire for inclusivity. Slack has Stuart Butterfield's focus on visual design